Mr. Crichton, having made it almost impossible for me to speak without it sounding like an anticlimax, I will say very briefly what I want to give you is a review of the scientific evidence for there possibly being something in UFOs, and then my own particular theories as to the possible relationship between unidentified flying objects and parapsychology. I am deliberately sticking close to the text of the articles which have appeared in Flying Saucer Review. This will, for one thing, make it easier for you to follow the argument. It will also make it easier for you to get the end of it, which will be in the next issue of the review. I'm covering as much of it as I can at the moment without going over the copyright of that. It has taken approximately 2,500 million years, or in modern terminology, 2.5 aeons, for biological life to evolve upon Earth and to attain a state of technological development where we can now break away from the gravitational pull of our planet and visit other worlds. So far, we have been restricted to the use of unmanned vehicles, but I think it would be quite unrealistic not to believe that within the next decade we are going to visit the moon and probably the nearer planets as well. These possibilities of interplanetary flight have only been known for about 30 years, and the possibilities of communication between worlds have only been known for about 60. Now, out of that vast time of 2,500 million years required for intelligent beings to develop on Earth out of primitive chemicals, the time required to go from a condition where we had no knowledge at all of communication by means of electromagnetic radiation to the time now when we can transmit television pictures from Mars to Earth is less than 100 years. That same brief period has also covered the transition from no knowledge of powered flight to the launching of interplanetary probes, and the transition from no knowledge of electronics to the construction of computers which near human thinking ability. I would like you to get this idea quite clear of a vast period during which development goes on at a very, very slow rate, and then a sudden enormous technological leap. What happens after that, we don't know. First slide, please. The picture is quite familiar to you, I'm sure, the Andromeda Nebula. And the reason why I'm showing it to you is because it is believed that if we were beings on a planet of a sun within that galaxy, our own galaxy would look very much the same. It is of similar type. It contains something like 100,000 million stars, and so does our own galaxy. We will see presently what this means in terms of the probability of life on other worlds. The next slide, please. The idea of there being other worlds at all, and of there being life on them, couldn't arise until people realized that the little bright spots that you see in the sky at night aren't pinholes in the floor of heaven, but suns like our own. Probably the earliest story about life on other worlds was that written by Plato a couple of thousand years ago, and medieval ideas were largely affected by ignorance of the fact that between us and other worlds there is an airless gulf. The atmosphere doesn't continue, so that this idea from the Middle Ages, due to Bishop Godwin, of flying to the moon by means of a set of trained geese wasn't realized to be impracticable at the time. Next one, please. And Cyrano de Bergerac, who's better known for his swordsmanship than for his science fiction, thought that it was possible by means of bottles of dew, which are lifted up by the sun's rays, he believed, to fly similarly. And the astronaut was not going to be inconvenienced by having no air to breathe, because he didn't know there would be no air for him to breathe. Next one, please. A little further on, you have this 16th century picture of flight, and it's not altogether irrelevant to our subject, because the very great astronomer K. Kepler, in his famous Somnium, had the idea that Theoxhilda, his mother, was a witch, and that she had flown to the moon in the conventional way. Next one, please. This most of you will recognize from Jules Verne's very fine book of A Voyage to the Moon. It's of great interest to us now because at the time Verne was slated by the scientists for suggesting that you could fire a projectile with a few hundredweights of gun cotton, because quite apart from what would happen to the inhabitants of the projectile, the projectile itself, if given sufficient velocity to break away from our gravitational pull, would be flattened. And of course it's interesting to note now that Project HARP, which is the Canadian scheme for launching satellites by means of a naval gun, shows every sign of being quite successful. Next one, please. Finally, you have the more conventional type of satellite launcher, and I would just like at this point to suggest that in the 300 years between the time when it was thought that witches might fly to the moon on broomsticks to the development of this rocket, there's been quite a change, and that that change may be reflected in the next 300 years. This thing may look just like a broomstick by then. Lights, please. Thank you. We are still a long way from having control of our environment, but with current progress with rainmaking by the chemical seeding of clouds and the French work in the Sahara with the Meteotron making artificial thunderstorms and tornadoes, it seems improbable that the final attainment will take more than another 100 years. And after that, unless the irresponsibility of our leaders hurls us into a final fratricidal war, it seems reasonable to look forward to a long time during which we can enjoy the mastery of ourselves and our planet. Earth will remain habitable for thousands and millions of years yet. So if we look from the distant past to the distant future, we see, and I reiterate it, that the changeover from a non-technological society to one with complete mastery of its planet occupies but the twinkling of an eye in the process of developing life. The consequence of all this is that the possibility of our ever discovering or being discovered by a race of extraterrestrial beings in a similar state of development to our own is negligible. The phase of transition from no technology to mastery of interplanetary flight is so brief that it can be ignored in relation to the time for which a planet stays habitable. The only race which could discover us would be one with a command of space flight, and therefore one with a highly developed technology. The only races which we could discover ourselves would be either those which have not yet invented machines, or those which are tremendously advanced. It's more likely, then, that they will have discovered us first, and they may have done so. The probability of finding life in the course of an interstellar exploration is obviously related to the time for which a community endures. One of the things we want to know is, do they always destroy themselves within a few decades of discovering atomic energy? Or do they survive the phase through which we are now going, when technology advances faster than human compassion, and go on to sociological attainments which we can't conceive? I think that in view of the opportunities for the triumph of brute force over reason, or even for the triumph of inanimate nature over organized life, which have failed to prevent the evolution of man so far, that there is reason to hope that communities do continue to endure until, in the course of astronomical ages, their planet is engulfed in the death struggles of its sun. Next slide, please. This, many of you will recognize as being a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, which gives the relationship between the stellar type shown at the bottom. You probably remember the full mnemonic for the types: O, be a fine girl, kiss me right now, sweetest. The important thing to note is the relationship between mass and temperature. And the next slide, please. And this gives you the ecospheres, or areas in which life could develop on the planet surrounding a sun. Where you have these very small stars here, stars like the M5 type, they only heat up a very small zone. On the other hand, because of this and the relationship between the rate at which a star is consumed and its mass, they last for quite a long time. Period on the main sequence here, 100,000 million years for an M5, but it's only developing a habitable zone which is about the size of the orbit of Venus. It's really quite small. On the other hand, when you come to some of the giant stars, they develop a very large area indeed, but their time on the main sequence is consequently so short that it's doubtful whether they could evolve life in the way in which it evolved upon Earth. Next, please. Now, when you consider these various factors together with others, ellipticity of orbits, most stars that you see are not single stars, are either binary or multiple, and consequently you can't get a stable orbit for a planet unless either you've got the two stars fairly close together, and the planet is travelling in an enormous orbit around both, which means that it is probably going from a fairly hot phase when it's close to both of them to a cold phase when it's a long way out, or it's pursuing some very complicated orbit like a figure of eight in between the two, which is likely also to be highly unstable. When you consider all these, it seems that only about 2% of multiple star systems could possibly have habitable planets, only about 10% of single stars. About 67% of the stars you see are binary and multiple, so it's fairly simple mathematics to get 4.5% of all visible stars as the maximum number which could have planets which might give rise to intelligent life. But as we saw earlier, the content of stars in the galaxy is about 100,000 million, which is quite a few stars. So even on that basis, with 100,000 million galaxies around, the number of planets which could have habitable life, as we know it, developed in the way in which we know it, is enormous. If we stick to our own galaxy, which is the only one we're ever likely to know much about, the number is still somewhere around 4,000 million possible habitable planets. Now, of these stars, which may have planets, like Earth, some of them are very much older than the Sun, some as much as 5,000 million years older, a few possibly as much as 10,000 million years older, and this means that if life developed upon their planets at the same rate that it developed here, it could have been technologically in advance of ours long before we climbed out of the primeval seas. The thing is, it implies that they might have been watching us long before we were capable of wondering whether we could watch anything at all. It's possible that, as Arthur Clarke suggested in one of his books, alien space vessels may have descended to Earth's surface countless times in the course of the ages. I'm rather interested in how the surveillance would be carried out. We're not really in a position to imagine the achievements of a race that's had science and engineering for a few million years, any more than a Neanderthaler could understand the International Bank or an atomic energy station. It is almost certain that if ancient races do exist, they would already have linked themselves up in some kind of interstellar community. Next slide, please. Earth, as you know, is somewhere out from the centre of the galaxy, which is in the region of the constellation Sagittarius. So here's the Sun with Earth and its other planets, and here is a region near the centre of our galaxy where I've indicated possible inhabited planets which are in communication with radiation. It seems to me that it might be a profitable thing to do to see whether you could detect any radiation in that way. The chances, of course, are very slim, because with any form of transmission that we know at present, you've got to beam it pretty tightly in order to make it travel even a few light years. So the chances of picking up radiation due to side lobes are very small. Lights, please. In as far as we can extrapolate current lines of progress, it seems more likely that interstellar exploration, which involves journeys of thousands of light years, would be achieved by highly evolved machines rather than by a biological organism. Machines, which, by analogy from our own Mars vehicles and that sort of thing, but vastly more complex, are going to be capable of analysing and photographing and recording and computing and finally transmitting back to their bases neatly documented surveys of everything they can pick up. The fingerprints of our newborn civilization may in fact already be known to the records department of some vastly distant older race. Before considering the other ways in which such surveillance could be conducted, we have to realise that the ways vary according to the types of entity that wish to know about us. We have seen a high probability for man being non-unique as an intelligence in the universe, but it doesn't imply that the other intelligences have to be like man. Now, although many animal lovers will claim a high order of intelligence for their pets, the only really intelligent organism at present known to man is man. By intelligence, we don't mean here the dictionary definition of intellect or understanding, which doesn't get you any further, but specifically a capacity for abstract thought. Within the compass of terrestrial scientific knowledge, we can conceive the possibility of three groups of intelligent organism, excluding man. Firstly, humanoid or non-humanoid biological species. Secondly, mechanical intelligences. And thirdly, stable, intelligent plasmoids. Despite the claims of spiritualists, psychic phenomena provide no evidence for the existence of disembodied intelligences. That is because these phenomena can all be explained equally well by alternative hypotheses based upon the powers of the human mind. We will now consider in some detail three classes of possible intelligent organism. First of all, biological organisms. I thought it was very interesting that the 1964 meeting of the British Association, the opinions of the scientists there, quite a number of quite orthodox biologists who thought that bug-eyed monsters were a lot more probable than humanoid species. Bug-eyed monsters, of course, because an animal is only adapted to its environment, it's only successful if it is adapted to its environment, it's only adapted to its environment if it follows its changes closely. Therefore, if an organism, if a race has developed upon a planet vastly different to ours, it will probably have developed a vastly different form of body. And since we always call a monster anything that isn't familiar to us, they're bug-eyed monsters. If we make the assumption that within limits the physical properties of material are much the same wherever they occur, then we can predict quite a lot of things. For example, the limit to the height of a living creature is reached at the point where its legs can't support its weight. So in general, the height of living organisms must vary inversely as the gravitational field of the planet. So you would expect giant planets to have animals which were something like armor-plated tortoises with multiple legs, and you would expect very small planets to have something like a cross between a giraffe and a jellyfish. These physical characteristics of biological organisms now bear a direct relationship to the possibility of the organisms being intelligent. Intelligence seems to be a function of the number of interconnections between the neurons of the brain. There is therefore a minimum number of neurons. And neurons themselves are quite complex things. They have to have a finite size. There is therefore a limit to the smallness of an intelligent organism. The brain of a man has somewhere around 10,000 million neurons, all of finite size. So it's unlikely that a really intelligent organism is going to be very much smaller than a man. It might be larger within limits. But there are limits again here. because, for one thing, of the finite velocity of propagation of nervous impulses. Nervous impulses vary somewhat in speed, but they are really quite slow. In a brontosaurus, it must have taken about 1.5 to 2 seconds for a message from its big toe to get up to its little pea-sized brain and say, "Hi, somebody's nibbling me." So by the time the message had got back from the brain to big toe to say, "Well, get out of it, silly," the toe wasn't there. This probably had something to do with the brontosaurus dying out. Now, all of this means, then, that there are very definite limits to the size of an organism. It can't be too big, it can't be too small. Two other factors which come in to limit its size: the square cube ratio, the chemical exchange which can take place on surfaces, that is, the absorption of food from the gut or respiration in the lung, is proportional to the square of the size of the organ. The total energy which the animal consumes is proportional to its bulk, and this is the cube of the size of the organism. Clearly then, as you go up in size, it gets more and more difficult for you to get enough energy quick enough to keep you going. So we expect that biological organisms are going to be within a fairly limited range of sizes. There are other requirements for intelligence. You need sensory organs to get data about your environment. You need motor organs in order to react back upon the environment. To come into senses, we have 5 well-known ones, and in addition to that, we have senses which relate to movement, position, acceleration, pain, pressure, and temperature. If I ask any of you at this moment to think what your big toe on the right-hand side feels like, you know whether it's hot or cold, whether you were thinking about it before or not. You've got a temperature sense. It's not normally counted as a sense, but it's quite real. Also, if this whole room started to rotate rapidly, you would know it. This is your sense of acceleration. But when you go beyond man, you start looking at some of the other animals on Earth. They had senses which make one boggle. The elasmobranchs, which includes the sharks, rays and dogfish, have some little organs known as the ampullae of Lorenzini, and these are voltage detectors. Now, they're pretty good. The gill movements of a common place generate voltage gradients of the order of about 1/1000th of a volt per centimetre. The organs of Lorenzini can detect something about 1,000,000 times weaker than this. This means that a place can bury itself completely in the sand, and a shark swimming by within about 10 metres, 30 feet, can detect it because of the telltale voltages given off by its gill muscles. And this is by no means the most remarkable. Mud snails and planarians have built-in magnetic compasses. Bees and king crabs can detect the plane of polarization of polarized light. The pit vipers, including rattlesnakes, are extremely sensitive to heat. They can detect a few hundredths of a degree, so they can strike at warm-blooded prey in the dark. The eyes of a common snail are sensitive to X-rays. So is the nose of a cat. Bees and butterflies cannot see red, but they can see ultraviolet. So, in addition to these senses possessed by various creatures, but not by man, there are undoubtedly lots of others which we haven't even yet thought of. And the sort of collection of senses and motor organs which perfectly realistic creatures on another planet might have would probably exceed anything the science fiction writer can dream up. Limbs, whilst a convenience for locomotion, are also a requirement for intelligence. The story of man's early struggles to intelligence was the story of his struggle to develop hands and then to free himself from the need to walk on them so he could use them for tools. It's interesting that the number of limbs employed by higher forms of life has stayed around 4 for an awful long time, although the insects have tried anything from 6 to a few hundreds. Now, biological to mechanical intelligences. 20 years ago, electronic computers were almost unknown. Today, they're used by tens of thousands. They are dealing with everything from routine addition and subtraction to advanced accountancy, astronomical calculations, and the economic planning of whole industries. The latest machines, although they're still in the experimental stage, not only think for themselves, but in some cases think better than we can. I won't go into the arguments now for describing what a machine does as thinking, except I do believe that if a machine can't think, neither can we. But I would like to show you a slide briefly. Some of you will have seen it in other worlds than ours. And this is a very frequent reaction to the suggestion that a machine can be intelligent. I call it the encounter of mechanical intelligence with human rage. Lights, please. In spite of the evidence, whenever mechanical intelligence is discussed, there are strong emotional denials that machines can ever think creatively. But our brains are relatively badly organized, they are inaccurate, and they're slow. They weren't even evolved for the purpose of abstract thought, or for the pursuit of elusive concepts like truth, beauty, and goodness. They were developed slowly over millions of years as a product of the struggle for survival. As Lord Balfour put it, our brains are essentially a food-finding system, therefore no more necessarily truth-finding than the snout of a pig. Now, it's very well to bear these things in mind when we think about the problem of how long it's going to be before we build mechanical minds, particularly since we now build mechanical muscles, bulldozers, that sort of thing, millions of pounds stronger than we are. The next thing is machines millions of times more intelligent. Most of the work on the early design of machines was done by teaching them to play games. Chess is particularly suitable. It's a microcosm of human struggles. It has its own hierarchy, rules, aims, logic. And the first chess playing machine was this one, built in 1769 by Baron Wolfgang von Kempelen. You can see the chess player here. It's a life-size figure of a Turk. There's the board. Under here you can see some sort of mechanism, which doesn't make a lot of sense. The machine is alleged never to have been beaten in the 80 years that it was around. It played against Marie Theresa and against Napoleon and beat both of them. It was possibly a fraud. Edgar Allan Poe suggested that it was operated by a legless dwarf, as he couldn't imagine anything else that would be small enough to get in. And it was only the fact that other people had objected that stopped Edgar Allan Poe saying a totally limbless dwarf, which of course would appeal to him more. The next slide, please. Now, von Kempelen's robot makes a bit more sense if you consider it in comparison with the machines of its time. Round about 1740, the brothers Drotz in Switzerland produced a series of animated dolls, of which this is one. These were wound up, and you press the button, and the thing then started to write, "I am Jan Drotz, I am 5 years of age, I like to play the spinet," and various other things, making a total in all of about 60 lines, written in a very nice copper plate handwriting, at the end of which it shook the ink off its pen and switched itself off. Now, for 200 years ago, that's not bad. The next slide, please. A big jump forward to 1914, when the Senior Torres Cavado, who was the director of the Automation Laboratory of Madrid, first showed this machine, which could win most games of chess against a human player. But when I say that, it could only play a limited game of chess. It couldn't use the full range of pieces. It could just play a king and a rook against a king. And this is not too difficult to push your opponent into a corner and finally beat him. Thank you. Lights. Well, today there are numerous electronic computers which are able to program themselves. That is to say, they play a game of chess, and when they make a move that doesn't pay off, they remember this. When they make a move which does pay off, they remember this. They then substitute this move in their memory bank for the unsuccessful one and play it next time. This isn't too difficult. It does give you an inkling, however, of how a machine can progress towards something which simulates intelligence. The rate of progress in less than 200 years from Baron von Kempelen's according to Edgar Allan Poe, fraudulent chess player, to our electronic computers, which can beat their designers, is fairly typical of the advance of modern technology. I've got a slide here which on a... next one please. Which on a rather arbitrary scale shows you what's going on. Starting off here with von Kempelen's perk and going on through the machines of Cavado to the first machine for playing noughts and crosses produced at NPL and on. I think it's fair to say that the rate of progress, as in so many things, is exponential. And where this is going to lead us in a few hundred years' time, again, your guess is as good as mine. Next, please. It is possible, too, that a new phase of evolution is already beginning here, mechanical evolution. It could be that the change from biological evolution, to mechanical evolution will prove to be of greater importance than the change which took place when we went over from chemical evolution to biological 2,500 million years ago. It is even possible, conceiving the idea of similar biological races on other worlds, that whenever the biological organism gets to a stage at which it can begin to understand its own physiology, it starts to plan to improve upon it and to make mechanical replacements. The report from the New York Memorial Hospital, about 2 years ago now, of surgeons cutting a man in half from the ribs down and fitting him with an artificial trunk, pelvis and legs, points to one way in which this sort of thing is going. And the Russian experiments of about the same period of keeping alive and supposedly conscious a monkey brain points to another way. There's another game which could lead computers to ruling the world if we don't watch out, and that is real-life monopoly. It won't be very long before political leaders realize, as scientists did quite a long time ago, that machines of superhuman thinking ability can be built and that they could completely alter human existence. Any nation which put out the tremendous effort, and it would be a big effort, to produce a mechanical minister, would want to get a fair return for its money. And that means it would use it to the maximum capability, it would use it for the most complicated thing known to man, apparently, that is making political decisions. Any restriction to the range of data that you supplied to the mechanical minister would limit his ability to make effective political decisions. But if you don't place any restrictions, then you surrender the control of your country to a machine. Of course, the other side is doing the same, and it ends up with the machine fighting the machine. If they've got any sense, they're not going to get involved. They'll just put the men in, and we'll be back to where we are now. It depends how you plan it. If you've listened to the fine robot stories by Isaac Asimov, you will build into all your machines a class one rule that you must never do anything to hurt people, and secondly, that if someone does get hurt, you minimize it. So they would figure out that wars were going to be darn bad things all the way round, and perhaps they would work it out the way that we should have worked out ages ago and just played out at noughts and crosses. Another thing about mechanical life, one of the arguments aimed against the possibility of such a thing, reproduction, usually thought of as something exclusively biological, isn't. It's a phenomenon of wide occurrence. It is something which begins to take place in all dynamic systems of more than a certain very high degree of complexity. You see this well in chemistry. The problem, and American engineers are already working on it, is to program a machine to make another machine like itself and to equip the new machine with a copy of the instructions so that it can go on. Slide, please. And of course one of them is saying to the other one, I wonder where it will all end. Lights, please. John von Neumann was the first mathematician to point out that it is theoretically possible for a computer to design a better computer than itself, and for the two of them then to get together and design a third. And this is a way in which mechanical evolution could follow closely on the heels of mechanical reproduction. And now for the third form of intelligence, stable intelligent plasmoids. A plasma is an ionized gas. That is to say, it is an aggregation of ionized and neutral molecules and atoms together with free electrons. And it is possible for such a system to store large amounts of energy. Plasmas are not a new discovery. Every time you look at a neon tube, you see a plasma, and all the old-fashioned wireless valves, which are now giving place to transistors, had plasmas in them. The properties of plasmas were based upon two discoveries made by the same chap nearly 400 years ago, William Gilbert, the physician to Queen Elizabeth I. In 1600, Gilbert found that an electrically charged metal knob loses its charge when it's brought near to a flame. That's a plasma property, that a hot gas, which is an ionized gas, can conduct electricity. And Gilbert is also remembered for being the first man to carry out systematic experiments on magnetism. And so you get the name magnetoplasmodynamic phenomena, which is a scientist's way of complicating things and describing the action of a plasma as being due to the combined action of electrical charges and magnetism. How can a ball of hot ionized gas be stable? Well, at present we don't know the answer, but that they can be stable is abundantly proven. For one thing, natural ball lightning, thunderbolts, have frequently been observed to persist for 5 or 10 minutes, and on rare occasions for more than a quarter of an hour. A study of magnetically confined plasmas was made at the University of California in their radiation laboratory about 9 or possibly 10 years ago now. They made donut-shaped plasmoids, which they shot magnetically out of a gun at 120 miles an hour. And although they moved so fast, they could be photographed by a high-speed camera. It was one of the first experiments in a chain of research going on in America with a double purpose. If you can produce artificial ball lightning, you've solved two things which are quite important, militarily at any rate. The first one, the ultimate weapon. Artificial ball lightning, if it's anything like natural ball lightning, could result in shooting an almost massless charge with an energy content at the rate of something like 400 pounds of TNT for a thing the size of a football. It would also, of course, solve the problem of limitless cheap power. Run your domicile for a penny a year on electricity. This is the sort of thing that thermonuclear power promises you, and the answer to both would be contained in the production of artificial ball lightning. Next slide, please. This is a reproduction of a drawing from a 100-year-old book, a little more than that actually, it's Arago sur le Tonnerre, and it shows a lightning strike on a conductor and the formation of three lightning beads at the end of the strike. Next one, please. This is a photograph reputedly taken in a wood in Switzerland in 1907 and supposed to be of a lightning ball of about 5 feet in diameter. Next one, please. This is the Bendix Corporation in the States apparatus for the production of small artificial lightning balls or plasmas. They use a conventional radar, the energy of which is concentrated into a partly evacuated tube, and when you're getting a nice output of energy into that conducting gas, they suddenly reduce the pressure in the chamber and you then get a lightning ball formed. Lights, please. Well, now you're going to ask, where does the intelligence come in? And I have to admit that it hasn't at the moment. But Dr. Kenneth Shoulders of Stanford Research Institute in the States is working on this. The United States Navy have commissioned him to produce a very compact computer, one with 100,000 million components per cubic inch. In other words, about 1,000 times more effective than the human brain. They hope that by making it small like this, it will be able to recall information at the rate of 10,000 million binary units a second. Now, Dr. Scholder's first model is going to be something fairly ordinary. It's going to be conducting strips of molybdenum on an aluminium oxide base, and it's going to run at red heat. But then he's working already on the long-term project, which is to use a plasma in which electrons and ions whirling in a matrix of magnetic fields will store the information being proportional to charge density. So you have the possibility now of a computer which consists of nothing but a mass of ionized gas. So it seems that there's another bit of science fiction likely to come true. Most of you will remember Fred Hoyle's Black Cloud, and the suggestion now is that instead of it coming from the direction of the constellation of Orion, it's going to come out of a North American university. Now, we've considered three types of intelligent organism which might exist in other parts of the universe. We now have to consider the means which they would have to employ in order to make contact. The first is direct visitation. We can begin by noting that alleged sightings have reported entities which could be any of the types of intelligent organism discussed. Among the reports every year we have humanoid and semi-humanoid species, others which could be described as humanoid robots, though I don't see what advantage a machine gets by making it look like a human being unless it does the job properly, and also things like will-o'-the-wisp, meteors, balls of fire, all of which could be plasma intelligences. Next two slides, please. One of them, and the next one. Both of these are from a book on physics written about 120 years ago by Dr. Dionysius Lardner, who described these things as slow-moving meteorites. Without a lot more evidence, it's very difficult to say what they are. They don't appear from the descriptions to have been boreal lightning or marsh gas, and for the want of anything else, I would think the most descriptive term was unidentified flying object. Lights, please. As for the means of transportation, we will try and simplify matters by discarding, right at the start, all transcendental devices of science fiction. That is, we are not going to have automatic dematerialization and rematerialization by a totally unspecified ray. We are not going to have doors through a hypothetical higher dimension, or hyperdrives which permit velocities in excess of light. So that the distant entities, whether they use their own bodies as spaceships or employ vehicles for the purpose, their machines, there's no reason why they shouldn't use themselves, are going to be limited by the velocity of light, and perhaps even more severely by problems of acceleration and deceleration. And it's also probable, even with machines, that as with human astronauts, there are limitations set by the need to minimize sensory deprivation and social deprivation. It's quite important to notice here that the recent work on sensory deprivation suggests that unless your means for analysing external data and sorting it and working on it is more or less constantly employed, it very rapidly deteriorates. The probability of visits from communities at more than a few hundred light years from Earth becomes very small then under these conditions. Even a visit from our own galactic centre, and at a velocity of one half that of light, that is 335 million miles an hour, would require 100,000 years. Now, we can't conceive even a machine. No machine has yet been built on Earth which continues around for that length of time. It's a heap of rust long before, let alone biological organisms with their lifespans at most of round about 100 years. It would be an unwarrantable dogmatism to assert that such voyages will always be impossible. But I do think they're so highly improbable as not to justify speculation. In the light of present-day science and technology, it seems very unlikely that it will ever be possible for man to visit worlds more than a few light years away, or for man-made machines to visit worlds at more than a few tens of light years, except on a one-way ticket. What then is the prospect for advanced communities being situated within a few light years from Earth and of them finding us, or of us finding them? Next slide, please. One of the things that is fairly obvious, the number of communities on the assumption that they are distributed more or less uniformly throughout the galaxy as a whole, is that they go up as the cube of the radius. In other words, as your radius of search goes up from 10 to 100 to 1,000 light years, the number that you are likely to find goes up from round about zero to round about a million. If you're going to go into this job at all, it's worth building a machine with lots of power in it. Next slide, please. And this is the sort of thing with which, of course, we are thinking of doing it. The Jodrell Bank radio telescope, at present engaged on other work. Though we shouldn't forget that Project OSMOR, which was the first serious attempt made by scientists to detect messages coming from other worlds, was really originated at the suggestion from Cuccioni and Morrison that Jodrell Bank should be used for the job. Next, please. So we come to remote communications. Project OSMOR was the name given to the attempt by Dr. Frank Drake of West Virginia to detect intelligent signals from Epsilon Eridani. I think that was the one that he concentrated on, but Tor said it was the other one he was interested in. The name of the project, Oz, of course, comes from Queen Ozma, who was the queen of the Land of Oz in the storybook, which was very, very far away, very difficult to reach, and full of wonderful and delightful things, a most apt name for the project. They used an 85-foot radio telescope fitted with the very latest receiving apparatus. They worked on it for about 3 months, during which they'd done about 150 hours of actual listening in. They terminated in May 1961, when after recalculating, they found that it wouldn't have worked anyway. They based it on the assumption that the people at the other end were using a telescope of at least the size of the Jodrell Bank, and they were working on the assumption that a transmitted power of 160 megawatts per megacycle was enough. Fresh calculations indicate that it probably isn't. You're going to need a radio telescope of something like 500 feet to make it work under those conditions. This isn't impossible. Now we come to the problem of how to carry on a two-way exchange of information. It's too complex to be gone into in detail, but there are some schemes which overcome the worst difficulties. The only real problem is how to get information across at any speed at all. There are two aspects. The first is that if you reduce the amount of information, the number of bits, as an engineer would say, which you want to transmit in unit time, it's easier to get a good signal-to-noise ratio, and so get a bigger range for a given power. The second is that for anything like a conversation, you've got this enormous difficulty that you've got to wait for your message to get to a distant star and come back. If you consider Tor Ceti and Epsilon Eridani, which is what Project OSMOR was listening to, and they are the nearest stars likely to be able to support life as we know it, it takes 21 years for a simple question and answer. This is worse than getting somebody to marry you. With planets at still greater distances, it gets quite ludicrous. You can't hope to get more than one or two questions across in a lifetime. All you can do then is to transmit an account of your own civilization and hope that the people the other side will take it in and send you an account back of theirs. This is the way in which it's suggested that it should be done. Next slide, please. I think most of you have seen it and you're probably familiar with it, but I'll go over it. This represents ones for pulses, zeros for spaces. They all occupy a unit of time. We'll say it's a second, it doesn't have to be. And it goes... and so on until it reaches the end. Then there's a gap. And after a fair time, you repeat it. The idea is that if you go on doing this long enough, some will say, it's funny, you know, but that series of buzzes always sounds very much the same. Suppose we tape it down. And when you tape it down, you find out that it comes out to a number, which is the product of two primes, in this case 19 by 11. And again, you reckon that it's not a terribly bright thing to think, well, let's arrange it in 11 rows of 19 or 19 rows of 11. one way you get this, which doesn't mean much, the other way you get that, which is quite suggestive. Very suggestive to us, might still be quite suggestive to another race. Now, of course, you can go on further on this basis. If they can work out the product of two primes, they can work out the product of three. And this means that you can send a set of instructions to make a three-dimensional object. In fact, you could tell them how to build a banjo or a bicycle if you thought it would be instructive for them. Right, please. I think this is the more likely way of going about it. I call it ambassadorial liaison. The NASA organization in the States is now working on plans for the Mars exploratory vehicles. Roughly, they hope to put pretty large satellites in orbit around Mars and to drop vehicles onto the Martian surface that are not far short of the size of a London double-decker bus and which are fully equipped with automatic apparatus for soil sampling, the detection of bacteria, and all the other things which give you an inkling as to whether there is or ever has been life on the surface. So, we're within striking distance now of a pretty colossal technological feat. What the other people might be doing could be miles in advance. If we accept this probability of innumerable other habitable worlds, many of them vastly older than our own, then we have to accept the idea that there could be probes around already which are vastly more complex than anything that's yet on our drawing boards. It seems very likely, too, that the way a more advanced race would go about it, even if it was so advanced that it consisted of one giant mechanical mind, would not be to go on these explorations itself, but to build lots of probes and pump them out. A very good way would be for these probes to go into a system that it wanted some information about and to listen out for any sign of organized radiation indicating that life was there. It could then copy the radiation, amplify it, and send it back again. And this would give some indication that there was something up there that could detect messages and do this. Subsequently, if it got useful information, it would tape it, and on this process of using high pulse powers and long intervals, it would slowly transmit it back to its base. Now, the $68 question here is, have we any evidence for anything like it? And we may have. 40 years ago, Stoner and Van der Poel, who were both distinguished engineers in the then relatively new field of radio, reported powerful and long-delayed echoes from radio stations, echoes for which at that time there was no explanation at all. They were looking for squeakers. You know, they were sending out a pulse, listening to go round Earth. They should get 7 echoes back in a second. What they were getting was a dirty great echo after 8 seconds. There was no explanation. Today, apparatus capable of producing these echoes is familiar to all microwave engineers. It first leaked out to the public about the time of the U-2 incident. Military aircraft like that are equipped with apparatus which listens out for enemy radars. It copies their characteristics. It amplifies the interrogating signal. It distorts them suitably, then radiates them, so that the interrogating station gets the impression of an aircraft which is a lot nearer than it really is, and over there, not over there, so all the guns start pooping off in the wrong direction. Now, quite clearly, space probes could use similar equipment, but not with a view to military deception, but as a simple statement which says, here I am, I can analyse and copy your signals, ain't I a bright boy, would you like to send me more information? Well, Stoner and Van der Poel may just have missed such an opportunity, and the visiting probes would then have gone on to other planetary systems, having reported back to their base that there was radio emission from the planet Earth, that it was a senseless jumble like that which we get from Jupiter. This brings us to another interesting possibility, that the emission from planets like Jupiter and Venus is only quasi natural. That is to say, that they are caused by something like the artificial control of weather, and that they have been given permanence and form by the artifice of intelligent beings. Visiting space probes which found evidence of communities just emerging from savagery just starting on the long struggle towards technological development. Might set up a repeater station, hoping that when the local race was intelligent enough, it would decode the message and then reply. So it is quite possible that various phenomena which we accept as entirely natural are in fact artificially induced. The radio emanations from Jupiter, in particular, are very peculiar, because instead of being incoherent outbursts of radio energy, which was the original idea, they were just things like gigantic thunderstorms in the Jovian atmosphere, they are now known to occur as tightly defined beams of frequency-modulated waves, so that they're a lot more like a radio lighthouse than a natural noise source. Jupiter? I don't know whether we can see it. You can just see it on this picture. You've got the familiar red spot there, and here you've got a faint shadow, which is the shadow of Io, the third largest satellite. And the interesting thing is that it seems to be Io which carries out the modulation of the Jovian radio waves. How it does it, we don't know, but the waves always modulate when there is a particular angular relationship between Jupiter's magnetic field and the position of Io. Next light, please. And perhaps too, while we're looking around at things like the radio emanations from Jupiter and Venus, we ought to pay more attention to the Lagrange nodes. These are the 5 points in space in the vicinity of every pair of celestial bodies where there is zero gravitational potential. If you're not familiar with the idea, and these are two celestial bodies, you have a zero here, where the gravitational fields balance. You also have another zero on each side of the two primary bodies, and two further nulls on either side of the point intermediate between the two bodies. These nodes were predicted by the mathematician Joseph Lagrange about 200 years ago, and it's only recently that evidence has been produced to suggest that they have a real existence. That is, that radio echoes have been found implying certainly a concentration of space dust at these points. A small probe, of course, would not be distinguishable from space dust at that distance. And in fact, such a machine could be lying out there waiting for the appropriate signal to start up its recorded message. Right, that finishes the review of scientific evidence for the possibility of something. And I now want to go on to my own ideas about parapsychology. Can I have a slide, please? This, in the time of Louis XIV, was the idea of a ghost. We don't seem in many ways to have got very far away from it, that the inhabitants of other worlds are so far in advance of us. When I say other worlds now, I'm not talking about other worlds in the astronomical sense, but in the spiritualist sense, that they haven't got anything better to do than to tweak our bedclothes off and try and frighten us. Lights, please. Lights, please. Thank you. It will be useful to begin by recalling the conclusions in 1871 of the London Dialectical Society. This was the first scientific investigation, and they said, 1. Sounds of various kinds appearing to come from furniture, floors and walls of the room, and producing vibrations which could be felt, appeared, without there being any obvious cause for it. 2. Movements of heavy bodies occurred without mechanical force or muscular action. 3. The sounds and movements occurred in the way and at the time desired by the sitters. By means of a code of signals, they could give answers to questions. The replies and messages obtained in this way were trivial, but they sometimes revealed facts known to only one of the sitters. 5. The phenomena required arbitrary conditions. It was noted that, above all, the presence of certain people seemed to be necessary to their production, while others hindered it. But it didn't seem to depend upon the belief or scepticism of the people in question. Nevertheless, the production of phenomena could not be guaranteed by the presence or absence of any particular person. The committee was quite unanimous on this, but there were various other matters, such as the alleged apparitions of hands and faces, spontaneous playing of musical instruments, apparent invulnerability of some persons to injury by red-hot coals, apports of various objects, and the prediction of future events they couldn't agree on. Slide, please. This is a photo of Cooler Bucks, which is quite a classical name in the field of fire walking, as he appeared at Carshalton in Surrey in 1936. I make no further statement about fire walking, except that it seems to depend very much upon the mind of the individual, more than playing around with things like alum and sulfuric acid on the feet, because at all the modern demonstrations there have always been university students present who are willing to have a go. A proportion of them always get over unscathed, and a proportion of them always get burnt, as I'm sure I would. Lights, please. Well, after 100 years, during which psychical research has increased to an enormous extent, it is deflating to admit that there's been very little real progress. The books on psychical research, published in large numbers, are mainly devoted either to summoning the faithful with the rallying cry that where there have been several thousand years of spiritualist smoke, there must be metaphysical fire, or else to attempts to debunk the whole thing by pointing to the admittedly numerous cases of fraud. Now, there are six possibilities behind the paranormal. One, the sceptical interpretation, which says it's all fraud and fallacy, or as Dr. Priestley puts it, a lot of bosh. The negative attitude isn't Dr. Priestley's, by the way. He regards such an attitude as stupid bigotry and dangerously unscientific. But it is the view of a very large group of orthodox scientists. Two, the theory of natural anomalies. This postulates that the paranormal occurs, but it is utterly without significance. It is a sport, a statistical fluke, an exception which proves the rule. To my mind, that's just nonsense. Three, scientific monism. This suggests that paranormal phenomena are genuine, but they belong to an order of physical occurrences beyond the scope of present-day science. With further advances in science, the paranormal will become normal, as the laws recognized by science become more representative of nature as she is, instead of as the scientist thinks she ought to be. This theory then provides justification for serious investigation of phenomena, and it has the merit that in course of time, something will be proved, whether it is popular or not. Four, the theory of substantial dualism, which asserts that paranormal events occur but belong to an order of mental events which cannot be explained by physical science. Then we have the synchronicity theory of Jung. This is the most difficult theory to follow. It supposes that paranormal events are not based on the causal principle, but neither are they based upon any kind of paramechanical mind-matter interaction. Paranormal events, according to Jung, are events connected by an a-causal principle. I hope you can understand it. I can't. Jung, please. You may also remember Jung for his book about unidentified flying objects. He seems to have changed his mind once or twice, but by and large his assertion has been that they're wishful thinking. That seems to be the basic thing, although it's tied up in rather more complicated language as to being the necessity for the belief in something a darn sight wiser and more stable than we are. Light, please. Finally, we have the supernatural interpretation. Paranormal phenomena are caused or mediated by disembodied intelligences, spirits, ghosts, or what have you. They are supernatural and beyond both reason and explanation. That's much the simplest one. Anybody want to stick to it? Now, it's only a personal opinion, but of the six possible theories, only two seem worthy to me. That's scientific monism and substantial dualism. The second of these, although it involves a difficulty which has puzzled philosophers throughout the ages, that is, how to explain the interaction of physical and non-physical entities, has the advantage that it is obviously suited to deal with the one special peculiarity of paranormal phenomena, often overlooked, which is that they are almost invariably connected in some way with a human being. Scientific monism, on the other hand, has the advantage that it can be backed up by the whole army of organized science. Now, there are two parapsychological phenomena by the names of prosopopesis and idioplasty, which you'll get used to before long if you don't know them already, which, no matter how erroneous they may be in theory, are such valuable concepts that you couldn't get on far without them. Prosopopesis is a word derived from the Greek prosopos, a theatrical costume or a stage character. It's used to denote any sudden change, whether induced or spontaneous, in an individual's personality. Sometimes people take leave of their usual personality and assume an utterly different one. They may lose their memory, their character may be completely changed, they may take a new name, they may hold new ideas. The new personality may remember the old one, but speak of it as if it were a complete stranger. The change from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde, or the other way round, may be ephemeral, or it may be a quasi-stable state and last for years. Despite the name derivation, it is not a question of play-acting. It is not a question of the person taking on a role for reasons best known to himself. It is a genuine change in the personality. It is a phenomenon that has been known for thousands of years. It is one which has been intensively studied since the beginning of this century. The name by which the phenomenon was known in the past was, of course, possession. And this must not be confused in any way with schizophrenia, which, although the name suggests a splitting of the personality, only involves a splitting away of the emotions from the rest of the personality, from the rational sentiments. And this, together with hallucinatory tendencies, leads to grotesque changes of the personality, but it is still the same person. Three slides, please. The first one here, I think, is rather delightful. Can you sharpen the focus a little? That's better. This is a 16th century painting of the 4th century Saint Zenobius. And can you see the little demons which he is exorcising from the mouths of his patients? And these are the little beings who speak with many tongues. The next slide, please. In schizophrenia, we have a change in the personality which causes the individual to see the world differently. This is one of the 20th century painter Louis Wain's pictures of pussycats. There's a whole series of them. The first one is quite an obvious picture of a pussycat, like you or I might draw. Then he goes on to this furry beast, and the last one looks more like a dahlia than a pussycat. The interesting thing, of course, is that this is precisely the sort of thing, is precisely the sort of view of the world which a schizophrene appears to have when he speaks to you, and it also seems to be the sort of thing which one sees in a psychedelic experience, and it is also the sort of thing that you produce under the influence of drugs like mescaline. Next slide, please. Just in case you should think it's anything new, this painting is by the famous 15th century Hieronymus Bosch. This is his idea of hell, I can well believe it. And incidentally, of course, it is a very well-known schizophrenic characteristic that the victim believes that his body is transparent and that he can see inside it. It is alleged, I think there is a good deal of evidence for it, that in many cases they have the paranormal ability to diagnose their own diseases, although they have no medical knowledge. But certainly they do have a great preoccupation with their own bodies, as this person appears to have. Lights, please. Now, idioplasty. The personalities which manifest themselves as seemingly new psychological individuals in prosopopesis all arise from a central idea, which has either been implanted by suggestion on the part of a hypnotist or introjected as an act of autosuggestion. The term was coined by Durand de Groe about 1800 to denote the implantation of ideas in minds made receptive by hypnosis, and later Okorovitz used the word to mean the physiological realization of an idea. Idioplasty has for centuries been thought to occur during gestation. Count Prozor published an account in 1922, illustrated with photographs, which were never proved to be fakes. of a cat whose kittens were marked with the date and some stars which were printed on a sack on which the mother was lying. The markings were formed by groups of black hairs on a white background. An older example occurs in the Bible in Genesis. And Jacob took him rods of green poplar and of the hazel and chestnut trees, and he pulled white streaks in them, and he made the white appear which was in the rods. And he set the rods which he had pulled before the flocks in the gutters, in the watering troughs, when the flocks came to drink, that they should conceive when they came to drink. And the flocks conceived before the rods, and they brought forth cattle, ring-streaked, speckled, and spotted. A more recent medical example is the following. A 25-year-old woman was 2 months pregnant. She was badly frightened by her 2-year-old son nearly cutting off his left thumb, the member hanging only by a shred of flesh. She was in the backwoods. She had no one to assist her. She dressed the injury as best she could. Her mind constantly dwelt on the subject, and in due course she gave birth to a boy whose left thumb hung from his hand by a pedicle of flesh. This was published in 1910 in the Journal of the State Medical Association of Tennessee. There are many similar cases in the medical journals. The foregoing all relate to an idea manifesting as a bodily change. The stigmata of the saints are precisely similar. But the concept of idioplasty goes a lot further than this. It proposes that where there is no physiological mechanism to materialize the implanted idea, where you're really aching to do something but there's no way by which you can bring it about normally, or where the mechanism is inhibited from working, as in the case of a medium who's been strapped down to her chair so that she can't move, then the idea still strives to manifest itself paranormally. Thus, the levitation of objects beyond a medium's reach or the apportation of objects from other rooms are supposed to take place by some sort of action at a distance. This notion is both too crude and too far-fetched to win scientific support without a great deal of observational evidence, but something of the kind may occur, and idioplasty in a more limited sense definitely does seem to occur. Incidentally, I'd like to give you my opinion on levitation. The cartoon is due to Charles Adams. I think it's absolutely delightful. Lights, please. There are many ways in which the concepts of prosopopesis and idioplasty are related to the subject of unidentified flying objects. For a start, prosopopesis, particularly in the form of rapidly alternating personalities, such as we have studied, clearly has a bearing on the so-called contactee experiences. Not on all of them, but there's a group which you can definitely recognize it. There is one very interesting application. Charles Bowen pointed out to me some time ago that there are lots of instances where observers report seeing an object, supposedly a spacecraft, swoop down as if it's going to land, and it passes behind a hill or a wood or something like this at a little distance. Within a minute or less, long before the observers have had a chance to get themselves together and approach the landing site, figures are seen approaching. They're stereotyped. They are usually dwarfs or giants and often described as hairy. Usually there is no encounter. Sometimes an exchange of signals is reported. And then the visitants turn back towards their ship. Instantly, the minute they disappear from view, the ship is seen to take off. As Mr. Byrne has remarked, this odd cycle of events has been reported too many times to be casually dismissed. There has to be a mechanism for it. Well, you may suggest your own. Mine is that some of the reported landings are genuine, but I think they're the routine sample collection trips of robot probes. This seems to me by far the most likely thing, that whatever the state of technology of other races is going to be, you'll find their probes long before you find them. But the craft which visit Earth are the creations of vastly superior beings. Their science does embrace a good deal of what is still parascience to us. Suppose then that in addition to radars which can listen for our emanations and send back false signals to confuse our tracking stations, and there seems to be evidence for this, suppose they have equipment which can track our thoughts. The landing vehicle then receives from a group of human beings some confused thought, something like this, a flying saucer. Here, Perhaps they're giants or hairy monsters. Let's run for it. Well, no sooner received than the reflected thought image is on its way. The human observers are met by visions of precisely the kind of alien creature they most feared to see. As soon as the craft has finished its job, which it's out of collecting soil samples, is only a minute or so, they lift the fear barrier, and the creatures disappear. Another obvious application of these parapsychological principles is to the notion of an elite in our midst. Demigods of normal human descent, or perhaps infiltration by the beings of an extraterrestrial race. The usual reaction to these ideas, at least on the part of orthodox psychologists, is that they are schizophrenic. And certainly it is a common schizophrenic symptom to believe that one is constantly in the presence of beings who are visible to oneself alone and who command one's every action. In olden time, these were thought of as demon familiars from the infernal regions, and today sometimes they're thought of as the pilots of flying saucers. But what about the people who claim extraordinary out-of-the-body experiences or possession by the minds of extraterrestrial beings? Ideoclasty and prosopopesis here explain how a central compelling idea, that of a race of supermen who will save mankind from his own homicidal stupidity, can produce subsidiary or alternate personalities with the reported characteristics. But where does the central idea come from? I'd now like to show another small group of slides. First one, please. This is a modern psychologist's attempt to estimate the intelligence of a number of outstanding people. As it's been projected back to front, I can't read them at the moment, but I'll give them to you because I've also got them noted on my script. The next one, please. This is very interesting. It's one of the drawings of helicopters made by Leonardo da Vinci, and the date for it is somewhere around 1500. Next, please. This is also very interesting because it's taken from a painting of that time. It's just a detail from a large canvas, and it shows what is obviously a child's toy helicopter produced by pulling a string. Until I saw this, I never had any realization that these things, which you used to be able to go and buy in Woolworth, were in fact 400 years old, nearly 500 years old. Next one, please. And this, many of you will recognize as the Kom Sangman, about whom I don't propose saying anything more at the moment, except that in connection with this idea of an elite, this is perhaps the most outstanding character of all. You probably know that Bernard of Fontenelle was supposed, from the age of 45 until he died on his 100th birthday, never to have aged visibly. But the Kom Sangman did very much better than that, because according to the historical records, he seems to have stayed at about middle age over a period of very nearly 200 years. You can definitely trace him over a period of about 70. This could just be a freak of human longevity. It could be something else. Lights, please. Yes, of that group of people that you saw, there was Descartes, estimated at an IQ of 150, Luther 170, Kant 175, Newton 190, Goethe 210, Mozart 165, Voltaire 190, Da Vinci 180, Galileo 185. We reckon we're doing damn well if we can knock up 140. There certainly are, even if it is only a purely human manifestation, there certainly are among us a subspecies very different to the general run. Ideoclasty and prosopopesis, then, can explain this compelling idea of a race of supermen. But is this idea picked up from others in the course of our workaday lives, or are we all, as some people believe, in contact with each other at a subliminal level? And if there is a universal unconscious telepathy between men, then why not between men and other intelligences? And perhaps the Russians are right, and their attempts to develop telepathy as a cheap and effective way of communication between Earth and the Moon is more realistic than things like the abortive attempt of Project Ozma. It could be that many of the strange mental disturbances which we put down to madness, genius, hysterical dissociation, or just plain drunkenness on a Saturday night are the early stirrings of idioplastic concepts produced by cosmic telepathy. On the subject of telepathy, I would like to show you just three slides. I'm not going into any further. You'll find this dealt with in detail in the next issue of the Flying Saucer Review. Next one, please. This little cage is precisely what it appears to be, a metal cage. Can you sharpen up the focus just a little bit? With inside it a bed and some apparatus. And it is that, thank you, used by the Russian professor Vasiliev, who's done a great deal of work on telepathy. In his experiment, the chap who was being experimented upon didn't know that he was engaged in a telepathic experiment. He thought that he was carrying out a routine medical examination. He had to squeeze a bulb with one hand and try and keep up a regular rhythm. Meanwhile, unknown to him, away in another room, some spooky bloke was trying to do a Houdini on him, was saying, go to sleep, go to sleep. And he was marking down on a tape the times at which he made his suggestions. The chap who was squeezing the bulb unknowingly was marking down on the tape his own efforts. And the thing was to find whether there was a coincidence between the attempt of the hypnotist to put him to sleep and the time at which he did fall asleep. Because if the experiment went on long enough, he always fell asleep. Sometimes it took a long while. Next slide, please. In America, Dr. Duan has been carrying out some remarkable experiments on telepathy. This isn't Dr. Duan. but he had rather a similar apparatus. What he did, in fact, was to control the alpha rhythm of his brain. We can all do this. If our eyes are open or shut, there's a difference in our alpha rhythm. If we think about a problem, such as something complicated like twice two, our alpha rhythm is immediately reduced. If we think of something really complicated, such as nine times nine times nine, it's quite suppressed for a moment or so. So Duan figured that he could pick up this change in his alpha rhythm, since it easily appears on an electroencephalograph, and amplify it to do useful things. So he found this worked quite nicely. He could think or not think and switch the lights on and off, or open the door for his car. This pussycat, which is nothing to do with that, is one of a series of experiments which have been conducted by Israeli scientists, so that you can measure an animal's reactions without the difficulty of having lots of electrical wires trailing all over the place. And this little cat can transmit certain physiological stimuluses, its body temperature, its blood pressure and so on, back to base. What is more interesting is that other scientists have recently produced a very similar box of tricks mounted on the head of some poor little puss, whereby by pressing one button they can command the thing to come, and by pressing another button they can command it to go. This is simply by either producing in it the attraction due to food or the repulsion due to a loud noise. In fact, it receives neither. It only receives an electrical signal of a different wavelength. What I'm trying to bring home to you now is the fact that although it may not be possible to transmit a complex idea, it is perfectly possible to transmit an idea, the idea of come or the idea of go, between even an inert apparatus and the brain of a cat. Recently, a number of people in America have reported hearing meteorites. Experiments have now been carried out which show that certainly some servicemen can hear radar waves. To be strictly truthful, they don't hear the radar waves, but they can hear what is called the pulse recurrence frequency. In other words, if they've got a radar which is working at a few thousand repetitions per second, they hear a high-pitched whistle. But this is not detected by their ears. If they're stone deaf or if their ears are plugged, they still hear the whistle inside their heads. And this also reminds us of certain experiments recently carried out on rhesus monkeys in the States, which have shown that you can produce a mental breakdown or even drive them completely insane by just transmitting television to them. They don't see the pictures, and they only get the radar waves. Lord knows what will happen if they saw the pictures as well. Can I have the next? This shows you what happens when a bird gets sucked into the air intake of a jet plane. It's fatal for the bird, It could be fatal for the pilot and his crew. Consequently, the Americans have become very worried about this, and they've done a lot of work on clearing birds, particularly large species, off their airfields. And how do they do it? Yes, you'd guess it, they do it by electromagnetic radiation. If you take a beam of radio waves, round about 10 centimeters wavelength, or at even longer wavelengths, out to, say, 600 megacycles, if you beam this down, but it doesn't have to be a very intense radiation, it is not a radiation strong enough to warm up the brain of the animal. There is no direct, obvious mechanical effect like that. At a very low intensity, the bird becomes paralyzed and just falls down. And this is what they do on the airfields. They have a beam like this, which is swept around the airfield when a large jet is about to take off or come in, and all the birds are paralyzed for a few minutes. Within minutes or so of the beam being turned off, they're happily flapping around and getting in everybody's way again. I think that's the last slide, is it? Thank you. Lights? Right. I don't propose breaking into the copyright of the next article in the Flying Saucer Review, which is the final one of my present series, in which I go over this matter and a number of other things and draw it out into a more coherent theme. But I would like you thinking back over what we've gone through to realise that we have a perfectly good scientific evidence, quite apart from the intuitive feeling that lots of us may possess about life on other worlds, perfectly good scientific evidence that there are suitable environments available. There are homes for life elsewhere if it has evolved there. And having looked at the possible ways in which communication could take place between worlds, there appears to be evidence for attempts having taken place, although we've got nothing terribly concrete to go on. There is also the possibility that we have overlooked a tremendously important field, that of parapsychology. The possibility that the emanations of the planet Jupiter, for example, may not merely be attempts to influence our minds, for all we know, they are effective in influencing our minds. There are so many things that go on in our minds that we can't explain, that there is always the possibility that they are due to an external influence. The one piece of scientific evidence which shows that this is an all-utter moonshine is this recent series of electrical experiments indicating that you can paralyze birds, you can drive monkeys mad, let alone human beings, with television, and that you can transmit information. And finally, we must briefly consider the social implications of coming into contact with superior races. There can be no question of their having any fear of us, crude though we may seem, since even a slightly more advanced society could, if it wished, completely exterminate terrestrial life with little or no effort, in much the same way as we exterminate what are vermin to us. On the other hand, it is probable that we have little to fear. Very superior races, societies of vast intellect, may well possess equally vast compassion. Although this is an idealist view, and I'm sorry to say it cannot be deduced from observations of human behaviour. The establishment of contact with any superior community would obviously be of unparalleled importance, socially, technically, and culturally. It could lead either to our rapidly attaining a superior status ourselves, or it could lead to our extinction. And it probably depends upon how well we can conceal or overcome our grave failings as social beings.